Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Wilner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is Brendan Canning, a local musician, that's his formulation, who also ends up working on movies every now and then, including Lindsay Mackay's Wet Bum, Pavan Mundy's Diamond Tongues, and Edgar Wright's Scott Pilgrim vs. the World. He also composed the score for Bruce McDonald's The Tracy Fragments and appeared in The Time Traveler's Wife along with the other members of his alt-rock Canadian supergroup, Broken Social Scene. Or is it Canadian alt-rock supergroup? Either way, they're super. And with the band releasing their new album, Hug of Thunder, this Friday, July 7th, it felt like the perfect time to get him on the show. Brendan picked Melancholia, Lars von Trier's 2011 study of the end of the world as experienced by a depressed young woman named Justine who has the misfortune of getting married as a previously undiscovered planet bears down upon the Earth. Kirsten Dunst plays Justine, Alexander Skarsgård is her fiancé, Charlotte Gainsbourg is her impatient sister, Kiefer Sutherland is Charlotte Gainsbourg's husband, and they're all going to die. But before that, there's cake. Cake and profound depression. Oh, one more thing. It was very rainy in Toronto this spring, and at one point we just kind of had to stop and wait out the storm, which results in a pretty abrupt cut around 20 minutes in. Sorry if that's a little jarring, but, you know, it's not the end of the world. This is someone else's movie.
I guess it was just the last thing I watched, and I, you know, really, and it was either that or Hell or High Water, which I haven't got around to watching yet.
Okay.
Other than, you know, a couple people giving it strong recommendation.
That's fine.
And, you know, Melancholy is just, it's just such a quirky film, you know, it's almost like when you throw the score in there, it just... It almost like sounds like Peter and the Wolf or something.
Yeah,
you know, actually, it's a very, it's like a fantasy. It's this weird, you know, even like it's built around a, you know, it's set in a castle.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a fantasy film.
Yeah,
a bizarre fantasy film.
Was this your first experience of it? Had you seen it before?
Oh no, I'd seen it before.
And had you seen it? Well, when did you see it first? Theatrically? Did you?
I don't think I ever saw it. God, did I? Maybe I did. Maybe I saw once in the theater, and then I DJ'd a party for E1, and then they sent me a bunch of DVDs. So I watched it again, and then just recently, I was like, oh, my girlfriend was over. It's like, oh, let's, you know. She had never seen it, or never seen any Lars von Trier movie. Oh, maybe, except for Elephant.
Okay. So, oh, wait, that's Gus Van Sant.
Oh, that's Gus Van Sant. Yeah. Oh, yeah, Lars von Trier. Oh, yeah, that's right. I was like, oh, yeah, this one's... okay, so she had never seen any Lars von Trier. So, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have thrown it. Yeah, we watched it right before going to bed, which, you know, really leads you into some disturbing dreams. Although then, you know, wake up, stay awake for 45 minutes, dwell on that, and then go back to sleep, and then have really interesting dreams, like, I'm in the countryside somewhere, traveling across North America, and I'm in this gorgeous place where... You know, all these women are cooking up food, and there's, like, lots of mushrooms. I don't know, I just remember, like, mushrooms, a lot of mushrooms. Yeah, yeah.
So
anyway.
This fascinates me, because I don't remember my dreams.
I hadn't been lately, but after that evening, yeah, I did have a very, very good dream of on a road trip with my old band members.
Yeah. So is your dreaming influenced by the thing you've just watched?
I think because it was just such a grand sort of... place that we had arrived that was really like non-existent, especially like I don't know, like because of my occupation I have lots of traveling dreams where you sure. just end up places that don't exist, but you know they're sometimes incredible places.
That's amazing. I yeah. had no experience with this at all.
Yeah.
I my first experience of Melancholia was an 8:30 or 8:45 a.m. screening at TIFF.
Ooh.
It was the first day of the festival proper, and so there were I don't know, 5 movies in a row that day. It was yeah. my first one, and it was a great way to start because it was the Lightbox One, that great big screen,
mm-hmm.
and you're hit with that opening sequence of slow motion disaster yeah. imagery.
Yeah, it's really...
No dialogue.
I know, it's no really interesting, like, especially, my girlfriend's much, you know, she's younger, and to throw a long sequence like that at someone who's never seen a Lars von Trier film mm-hmm. and just sort of know nothing about this film, and then all of a sudden you're hit with all these images, and she just sort of blandly said, oh, so I guess this is foreshadowing. I'm like, well, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
And it's that Cassandra aspect of the movie, too, where you spend the whole film trying to figure out if Kristen Dunst's character is haunted by visions of, if that's why she's depressed. I mean, that was my way in. I was trying to figure out if this stuff has been in her head all along. Yeah. She knows everything's coming to an end, and that's why she can't rouse herself to life.
Yeah, well, she does intimate later on, like, I know things.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the number of jelly beans in the jar or whatever. Yeah. And I think it was like 658 or 40. That's got to have some significance to something.
Right, it can't just be a random number.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
It's like a prime, or it's divisible by something.
Yeah, it's something smart, I'm sure.
Or it's the number of pills that von Trier has counted out for himself, because he has spoken about, you know, like how this movie emerged from his own depression and trauma, that it's his way of coping with his feelings. We might as well jump right into that. If it is a film about depression, it's an incredibly effective one.
Yeah. See, I'd never done any, not until right before I was coming over here, after listening to Sophia speak about Dancer in the Dark in a previous podcast of yours, then it's like, okay, you know, I've heard so much about Lars von Trier, but I've never actually, you know, and of course, like, you know, the racist comments he made during Cannes and stuff, you know, and I never really investigated much until I finally, like, okay, Lars von Trier, racist, and, you know, see what comes up.
That's your search term.
Yeah, that was my, and,
it must have been fun.
Yeah, and just, like, because I had, you know, I had no real interest in the type of person he was other than, you know, like, seeing these strange films like The Idiots or whatever. Like, even in Melancholia, like, there's that scene where Dunst is, like, eating some yogurt or something, or I don't know what she's eating, and it was just, like, in The Idiots where, like, girl's, like, eating something and starts slobbering it, and her father slaps her in the face, and it's like, oh, okay, he's on a theme here, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, I've just, you know, never been curious enough, like, even with, like, bands I like, I'm just never curious enough about the individual behind it. I'd rather just have that be, you know, not part of the equation as to sway my judgment one way or the other.
Experience the art.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the argument we always make for people who are problematic as artists, right?
Like, yeah.
Polanski, like, back in the news now, trying to get his conviction overturned, wants to come back to America. Yeah. It's not the rape so much as the whole flight from justice thing, which he seems to have missed. Like, that's the reason they won't let him back. It's that he fled. But any conversation of that is also, well, he did make Chinatown and Rosemary's Baby, so he's not a monster, or he understands monsters well enough to be an artist, or, like, that whole thing. Von Trier just seems deeply invested in being an asshole.
Yeah.
But people,
you know, I don't know if Miles Davis was such a nice guy either.
Apparently not.
Yeah. No. You know, I read a biography.
But it's a thing, right? Like, it's the kind of thing that when I watch his movies, I try not to think about whatever brutalization he's doing to his actors or how he's getting these performances. If the movie is working, you shouldn't be thinking about that.
So. Yeah, I'm never, you know, never, ever thinking about that. Just because, you know, I play in a band. It's like, yeah, sometimes your bandmates are dicks. Or, you know, sometimes whoever they are, you know, can be unreasonable individuals, and you're just whatever makes good music in the end.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's worth it.
It's a weird place to watch the movie from, though, because you're watching, as with most of his more recent stuff, you're just watching emotional brutality and misery for the purposes of entertainment. But in Melancholia, I'm not a fan of Dancer in the Dark. I'm not a fan of Nymphomaniac. They felt a little self-indulgent, more than a little self-indulgent. But with Melancholia,
I never saw Nymphomaniac, but I just remember watching Dancer in the Dark and the two women I was with watching it. And, you know, I was, you know, it was very sad, but then I looked over at them and they were just crying, bawling so hard. I was like, yeah, I guess it is pretty sad. But,
With Melancholia, it seems to have, it all seems to work to me to some larger end. It feels more powerful, or it seems to land with me, I guess. Yeah.
Well, I didn't miss out on some comedy in there too. You know, like
the first hour is basically a comedy of manners at a country dance.
Yeah, like Kiefer Sutherland is pretty hilarious. You know, just, you know, even right down to when in the second act when she, her sister's trying to get Justine to take a cab, and it's like, don't worry, we'll take care of it, and he's in the back and saying, we'll see about that. Yeah. Or the wedding planner, every time the wedding planner walks by, he like has his hand guarded because he refuses to look at Kirsten Dunst. So, stuff like that, it's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I think. Anyway, I laughed.
I mean, if the world is going to end, it's a very enjoyable apocalypse movie.
Yeah.
As they go.
Yeah. I did Google the Ant Steelbreaker thing. I tried to get by. I didn't quite get why it was.
I think it's just something he likes. I think a lot of the movie could be boiled down to he wanted to use that.
Yeah.
Like it's a phrase or a thing or a sound. What was it? Oh, weirdly enough, Hawksley Workman and I had a Twitter conversation once where we were talking about lyrics, or he was talking about this one turn of phrase, and I butted in and just said, oh, I like this one that you did also. Yeah. And he said that he doesn't know where they come, he doesn't care what they mean, he just likes the way they sound.
Yeah.
That the phrasing is all that matters.
Yeah.
And I get that with this. Like, this,
sure.
That came to mind watching Melancholia, because it feels like, how can I put it, it's an intuitive narrative. Like, I get why this is happening, I understand it, even though there's no rational explanation for half the stuff that happens, both cosmic and personal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, there may be nothing behind it other than, the way the syllables come out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is how it wanted to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I like it, though. Ant Steelbreaker.
It doesn't make any sense, but it sounds
cool.
Yeah. And the name of the planet being Melancholia, a previously undiscovered world.
Yeah.
Of sadness.
Yeah. I mean, that in itself is pretty funny.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to look at it in comedic terms.
And also, if you're taking it straight as the onset of depression, it feels like, supposedly, I've never experienced clinical depression, but from everything I've read, it's apparently a weight pressing, it's something that you can't stop coming from the outside that destroys you.
Yeah.
And so a planet-sized depression for von Trier makes perfect sense, because that's how he would see his own issue.
That's when it becomes less funny.
Yeah.
I mean, as being, someone who, I'll experience sadness, but as far as clinical depression, I can't. Definitely been in the thick of it, but not personally.
Mm-hmm.
So, but being in the thick of it is quite an overwhelming sensation sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, it's the nature of empathy, right? You can understand what it must be like.
Yeah.
But the metaphor that he comes up with is, it's ingenious in a weird way, and a unique and idiosyncratic way, which is him. Like, that's totally what I get.
Well, the fact that, it's coming closer. No, it's going further away. Now it's really close.
Yeah.
But it's still sort of painted in this, it's just a fantasy world.
Mm-hmm. Everything's really beautiful. Everything's really expensive.
Yeah, so it's how many holes on our golf course? 18. But then there's like the one, they show the 19. Flag, yeah.
Yeah. According to the IMDb, he says that means limbo. But I think he might have just been saying that to get someone to stop asking him.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's like, this is what's so fascinating to me about his filmmaking. There are simple explanations that you can just look at in universe and think, oh, this is happening because of this thing that happened 10 minutes ago.
Right.
But it's also possible that he just decided to throw this thing in. Why does the fox talk in Antichrist?
Right.
Why is it eating its own maggoty body? Well, you want to build a fox, that's what you're going to do.
Yeah, I got to see Antichrist. Or maybe not, I don't know. I mean, I just watched Melancholia, so I'm good for a minute or two.
But... Yeah, Antichrist is...
When did that come out?
2009, maybe, or 8? It was before Melancholia.
Okay.
That's how I relate to him, with One Up, One Down, I think. I like every other one of his films.
Yeah.
Yeah, I like The Boss of It All, and then Antichrist came out, and then Melancholia, yeah.
Yeah.
And then Infomaniac. But he's a fascinating filmmaker, because he creates these incredible textures and then rejects them half the time. Like, you've got all the wedding stuff that's only really in the first two-thirds of the movie, because then it just boils away because it's not important anymore.
Yeah.
It's about the isolation that these characters are feeling.
Well, yeah, the wedding is really puzzling on a lot of levels because there's just, who are all the guests?
Yeah.
There's no story about any of that. You just sort of, you're just, you know, suspend your belief, I guess, mm-hmm. or why are they 2 or 3 hours late? You know, where was the I guess the ceremony must have been in the village.
Presumably. Yeah. Or it might have been on top of a car, for all we know.
Yeah.
We don't experience
it. But then, why, you know, yeah, the whole thing, it's like, kind of starts out, yeah, it just starts out sort of like, slightly comedic, but really uncomfortable. Like that limo, just trying to make all the turns and stuff, it's just,
it's excruciating.
Yeah, like right off the bat, you're just like, want them to not be in that limo at whatever cost, and then, you know, they all take a crack at trying to drive the car, and, you know, it could be seen as comedic, but it's anything but comedic, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny until you're in it, I think. That's what the movie does right away. We are in that place with those people instead of just watching them. It's not an observational comedy, because I thought that's what he was going for as well. Yeah. At first, oh, the title's going to be ironic, and then the first 9 minutes of misery and galactic misery that you see with these nightmares and these visuals that just don't make sense and are so painful to watch. And then you're back into this handheld silliness, which then isn't silly anymore.
Yeah, that's the thing. A lot of the, you know, some of the camera work is just so, like, shaky.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been doing that for decades.
Yeah.
And it's mean.
It's, I don't know what sort of sensation it gives you, but it's definitely, like, one of claustrophobia for sure.
I had a couple of friends who got motion sick at it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I think it was Kiva Reardon who, was it Kiva? Somebody tweeted a photograph that they had added at the Varsity, a sign that says, this film is very, very nauseating. They had to put it up once it opened.
Right.
You may get sick. And she tweeted the photo and said, yep. Oh, and it's, God. Yeah, I'm not susceptible to that sort of thing.
No. I mean, I didn't, you know, once again, you know, my girlfriend was like, the camera work is really hard to take. And mm-hmm. I said, yeah, Or she just said, yeah, it's a very interesting choice to make it so shaky. I said, yeah, I guess. Never really thought about it, but yeah.
Yeah. He's been doing that. His first three films were so elegant.
Yeah.
Well, I guess really Europa sort of peaked.
Right.
With this beautiful Steadicam widescreen framing. And then he almost immediately sort of rebelled and made Breaking the Waves and Dancer in the Dark and just high-end, tiny cameras. I think Breaking the Waves was shot... Yeah, it was shot on film, but it was a nightmare of steady camera-y. Or not even steady cameras, just handheld everything.
How many... was there, like, divided into 7 chapters was Breaking the Waves?
Breaking the Waves has chapter headings, yeah.
Yeah, and all, like there's a Deep Purple song...
Oh,
there's all that are like,
there's one version has Life on Mars at the end and the other one had it replaced,
but there's songs for each.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. Cause I remember like before I worked on that Paul Schrader film, The Canyons, mm-hmm. you know, they were saying, oh, you really like saw The Canyons as, you know, in chapters like Breaking the Waves, and I watched Breaking the Waves, and I was like, I just read the script for The Canyons. I don't know how this is going to be in any way comparable to that film.
I don't see the connection.
No, there wasn't. And the whole chapter thing, you know, I just was like, oh, wait till these emails go away. That's not going to happen.
I guess, like, I mean, Schrader's a very religious filmmaker. Like, he's always been really aggressive in his conversation about, you know, like with Taxi Driver is a kind of passion, and then he made wrote The Last Temptation of Christ.
Yeah.
I could sort of see Breaking the Waves appealing to him that way, but because it's ultimately a story of martyrdom, but I don't see The Canyons as a story of martyrdom.
No, it's more just, I guess the only comparison, a whole slew of tragic characters.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly that's, you know, whether you've got Kirsten Dunst or Charlotte Gainsbourg or Kiefer Sutherland or either Skarsgård and it his son?
It is his son.
Yeah,
his
father
and son, the two Skarsgårds. I think it's the only time they've appeared together.
Yeah. I guess the son is maybe I guess he's the least tragic because at least he's getting out.
Yeah.
And he's a young guy.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, you can say he gets out, but everybody dies, so.
Oh, yeah. Where do you go, true, right? Yeah, I forgot about that. The planet crushes everyone. I don't know.
Yeah. I am fascinated by apocalypse movies that don't come at it directly, that take the other option, you know, as opposed to the scenes where the government is wondering what to do and the scientists are making warnings and the three heroes ultimately come together in the third act. Of that stuff, we've seen that since the 50s, probably. And yeah, Melancholia doesn't feel like an end of the world movie, even though the world is ending from the beginning. And we watch.
I think just because, you know, you've got these scenes of riding horses shot from really high above, you know, that give, you know, the sort of majesty mm-hmm. of the whole castle and everything. It's just like so majestic.
Yeah.
That sort of make you forget that it's a film about, you know, depression and the end of the world.
Yeah. Basically. Well, what you had said before about how it has fantasy aspects, I never really thought about them that way, but yeah, it is.
Just the score, it really makes you think of, you know, that's the first, I don't know why Peter and the Wolf came to mind, but that's sort of, Prokofiev.
Yeah. It's the playfulness of the writing, right? Like, you know, it knows, it's self-aware in mm-hmm. its storytelling.
Yeah, and, you know, the Kiefer and Charlotte's son there, whatever, you know, he mm-hmm. sort of, that helps with the playfulness, I guess, just a young boy, and, you know, even right to the very end, building the, you know, the little cave, whatever, mm-hmm. I don't know.
It will save no one.
Yeah.
It's that strange austerity. Everything's so beautiful and everything's so appointed and expensive and carefully created, and none of it means anything.
Yeah.
Like that could be a metaphor for filmmaking too, if you want to take it that far. Like, no matter what you try to do, something else will come along and derail or destroy you.
Yeah.
I just wonder what it's like to conceive of something like this and then sell it to people, get the actors on board, get people involved.
I was thinking that too. You know, because, who's her father? Is it John Hurt? No.
I think it might be.
But, you know, what do you tell? Yeah. It's like,
John Hurt.
Yeah. I mean, what do you tell everyone in the film? Like, how do you describe this film? I mean, it's really, like, wedding speech is just like so classic. Like, the mom is just so biting, and you know, the mom is a real, what's her name?
That's okay, we can look it all up.
Because she is a, you know, she turned in a great performance.
It's Charlotte Rampling, isn't it?
What's that?
Is it Charlotte Rampling? Yeah, there she is.
Oh, wait.
Unless I'm wrong, Charlotte Rampling plays.
Oh, Charlotte Rampling. Yeah, that's right.
Plays Ginsberg's mother.
Yeah. Two Charlottes.
Yes. Yeah. So Charlotte Rampling.
Yeah. Because, you know, when the younger Skarsgård goes to give, you know, his wedding speech, he's like, I'm not very good as, you know, said, Justine's always better at speeches. It's like, well, why don't you let her talk? You know, just.
Two champagnes too many.
Yeah, you know, they just really nail, like, the tension of the family and just how they all ended up in this sort of fucked up place, I guess. And, you know, she's sort of, you know, Dunst is saying how she's, you know, Mom, I'm really scared. You know, I'm really scared. It's like, I would be too, darling. Run, you know, run as fast as you can away from here.
Yeah. That sort of thing is.
Oh, that was a question too. Like, why is she American, but everyone else, like, her parents are British.
Everybody else is English.
But Charlotte's English too. So maybe she went away. Maybe the husband and wife broke up, he went to America and met, because you never hear his younger wife talking. That's in the film. So, and then, you know, maybe Kirsten was, you know, 4 years old, 5 years old, and went to go live with your father in America.
Right. I love the way movies can always handle that stuff, or they refuse to acknowledge it entirely.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of stuff that it doesn't, but you know, at the same time, you just have to suspend your belief and, like, this is what's happening.
Yeah, this is who these people are.
Yeah.
It's like, they're Swedish people.
Yeah, you don't see any friends of the bride or the groom or any interaction at mm-hmm. any point in the film.
Oh, yeah. I just assume they couldn't afford to come out to this thing wherever it is, that her friends don't make the same money or aren't covered. It feels like an aristocratic remove, doesn't it? Like everything in the film is happening away from the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And these people are operating in a different bubble.
Yeah, which, you know, adds to the fantasy aspect of the film again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like, oh, I don't know. This is just the way the story is. Yeah. You're not, it's not a typical, you know, you don't see his parents at any point in the film.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, it felt like I was thinking of stuff like Buñuel, maybe, the isolation in his films where a group of people gather for mm-hmm. a thing, and that's the only world we ever see. But the absurdity of those movies, you know, people sit, or La Grande Bouffe, where people sit down to this great buffet. It's not a Buñuel film. I can never remember the director's name. Marco Ferreri.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's the film where everyone does have this most incredible meal because Louis Prima is supposed to be coming?
Oh, Big Night.
Big Night.
Big Night.
I love that. That just made me think of that.
Magnificence of Big Night.
Love that.
Just watched that again a couple of years ago with people who had made a timpani for dinner.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, our friends Patchen and Andrea, and it was magnificent and decadent and everything you needed to be. And then you watch Big Night and just remember how good that movie is.
Oh, yeah.
Which is on the verge of being lost, I think. I believe it's out of print because it was hard to find the DVD.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I had one, of course.
Of course.
they were saying we couldn't find one to rent it, and it's like, I'll bring mine. But,
a great film.
No Blu-ray release. It's almost, it's in danger of being forgotten. It's one of those little indies that Sony put out on disc in the late 90s that they didn't have the rights to theatrically, so those video rights have lapsed.
Who directed that?
Stanley Tucci and Campbell Scott, I believe.
Oh, yeah?
Huh. Yeah, they directed it themselves.
Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, Tucci still owes me an interview. He bailed on me.
Oh, right.
At TIFF that year, yeah. Stanley, if you're listening.
I just love one of the scenes I remember the most of that film is just the next day. They're just like...
Oh, the omelet scene.
Yes, making eggs.
Yeah. One take.
Yeah.
And it says everything. No dialogue. Just...
Oh, yeah.
Just beautiful.
Nice bread.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, you assume it's nice bread. It's got
to
be.
Yeah. It would have to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. I have a feeling that...
Film that has little to do with melancholia.
Well,
I guess
it weirdly does, though, because as you're saying that, I'm thinking, well, that is the end of their world.
Yeah, right?
Like it is another film about the end of things.
Yeah,
it's
definitely loss.
Yeah, and if melancholia had ended without the planet destroying it, if it was simply a means to make people think about the rest of their lives, it would still be just as valid, I think.
Yeah,
because it's about the mistakes and the choices and the deliberate choices that you make.
Yeah.
I mean, a wedding is sort of the biggest choice someone can make in their life.
Yeah.
And to have everything else spiral out of that decision and then be invalidated by the end of everything.
Yeah.
Is sort of, like, that's the ultimate story, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe so.
Pure storytelling. Yeah. Pure narrative.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And the fact that their marriage lasts less than
that's true.
6 hours, presumably.
Even that.
One thing I really... like is the fact that there seems to be the concept of time on the wedding night seems to just be like all over the place.
Yeah.
Just like, I thought they were going to bed now. Oh no, the party's still going. It's like, what time is it? The car rolled in 2 hours late. The wedding planner is just, you know, averting his gaze every time he walks by Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah. It's that moment in a real event where it should be over, but people won't leave, and you don't know if you're upset about that or just enjoying it.
Yeah.
It's, it felt...
The searching for the tagline, too, that's such a...
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Like, that's just the... I guess maybe that's just a... You know, maybe Lara's just saying, it's like...
Keep
it's rolling. All people want. They just want a tagline. They just want to package it up neatly and have everything be perfect. And I like that, you know.
Yeah. You never get it.
You'll never get it.
You'll never get it, and you'll die trying.
Yeah.
And it's so... I don't know why I'm not more upset watching that film. It's a joyful end of the world. It's a pleasant experience to watch these people suffer, which I think is what von Trier does.
Yeah.
He makes it, if not emotionally entertaining, then cinematically alive.
Yeah.
In a way that keeps me coming back.
Well, maybe, you know, you get glimmers of, you know, such a, you know, a seemingly warm relationship between Kiefer and his son, mm-hmm. you know, and even though, like, Kiefer's end is predictable, I guess, you know, yeah. as being the staunch, hard-nosed, rich guy who just, you know, is chastising Charlotte for, you know, buying a bunch of pills, yeah. and then ultimately it's like, oh, let's see, is he really, is, what's going to happen with that jar of pills?
Yeah. It's not even a MacGuffin.
No.
It's just the coward's... Is it the coward's way out or the scientist's way out, the logical way out? I don't know. Again, it's one of those things where you... Penn and Teller did this thing on Apocalypses once on their show Bullshit, where they just punctured the idea of prepper culture by saying, look, if something that big happens, you're almost certainly going to be dead in it. That's what's going to happen. We're not preparing for the apocalypse because we will probably not survive the first wave.
Right.
A planet hitting another planet... I don't imagine there was going to be a lot of time to take that in.
No.
And so when we find Sutherland, when that story is resolved, it feels like I was pissed off at him. I was annoyed. I wasn't...
Oh, the fact that he... Yeah.
That he chooses the way out. I think it's because he has a family and it just seems weird to go out before your kid.
Yeah.
But Yeah. But then you think, well, he was kind of an asshole. He was sort of...
Yeah.
That's kind of what you do if you're a jerk. It's selfish.
And yeah, and he's just like, she'll explain it to him. I mean, we're all gonna be dead in so long. Like, does it really matter?
Yeah.
Like, we literally have, you know, 6 or 8 hours left, or 12, or however long it is.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, at that point, it's like, it really doesn't matter. Whatever he does, is he gonna be judged in the afterlife because of that one move? I don't know.
Yeah. I was wondering if it's von Trier's commentary somehow on his own depression. This is like, by the time someone does kill themselves to make this stop, we're mad at that character. We're annoyed with it. So is that what you write when you come out of something that dark and you can see the way forward? Or is it just, this is a, like, if, you know, the argument goes, all characters are facets of the writer.
Yeah.
Does that mean this is the part of him that wouldn't have made it? I'm just, you know, you want to pick that apart.
Maybe he probably just, merely
did he even consider any
proselytizing here, but I suppose he's just saying, like, well, people hate me anyway, like, what the fuck does it matter? You know, it's like, if I kill myself, people will be like, he was a fucking dick.
It's true. It's, you know, now people say when you die, it's, if you have an Oscar or an Oscar nomination, that's the first line of the bio. With von Trier, it'll be Lars von Trier, who was banned, who's the first person to be declared persona non grata at the Cannes Film Festival. So you might as well have fun.
Well, you just can't be throwing around a little Nazi term like it's something to joke about.
It's so weird, though. I get it. I get how uncomfortable he can be in these situations. His explanation was, and you know what?
Oh, yeah, I read the explanation.
If loving Wagner makes me a Nazi, well, I guess Hitler had some good ideas or something like that. You know, don't say that into a microphone.
Yeah.
Even when you're kidding.
Yeah, but it's just, but if I thought it, then I have to say it.
Exactly.
You know, it's like, okay, but I guess that, you know, that's whatever. That makes...
It's who he is.
Yeah, it's who he is, whatever.
That's how we get this.
Yeah.
So potentially a difficult part of the podcast, but how have you incorporated or absorbed or riffed on or borrowed any element of this? Is it anywhere in your creative DNA?
Specifically...
Does it ever come up? Is it something you've used? I mean, it's an easier question for filmmakers because, you know, you can visually quote something or you can lean back on something. Is there a song that deals with the theme? Have you yourself thinking?
No, because I don't, I mean, I think my thing is just so different than what this, which is probably why, you know, I'm drawn to something like this, because it's just,
it's outside
not, you. Yeah, it's just not my wheelhouse at all. And I, you know, like, I'm not a classical composer, and you know, the tunes, like, whether it's Social Scene or whether it's my own stuff, I mean, it's way more dreamy and idealistic, I think. And I don't know if idealistic isn't the first thing that comes to mind when I think of Melancholia or The Idiots. Or
it's funny though, when I think about some of Broken Social Scene stuff, there's a crescendo thing, a repeated crescendo, or an idea of building to an explosion that does make me think of the construction of this, and maybe the beginning of Antichrist, which you haven't seen. So, but again, similarly, they're sweets.
Yeah, I guess, you know, and we definitely, I guess, are, you know, for lack of a better word, like deconstructionists sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll make something that could be really pretty and try and wreck it a little bit and then try and make it pretty again, or, you know, sort of wrestle with a lot of different ideas and pushing and pulling that comes from having a lot of cooks in the kitchen, I guess.
Maybe that's it. Maybe it's just the question of getting all the way through something to the end, coming out the other side.
Yeah. But
yeah, it doesn't.
I'd still like to think that we feel a much. I mean, there's positivity to be taken from this film, but it's mainly, you know, it's. I mean, it's positivity because it's. You know, like you said, it's an enjoyable film to watch, even though it's.
Yeah.
This film about, you know,
the end of all.
The end of all and overwhelming depression. Whereas I think, you know, with our group, we're trying to combat that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you gotta have the yin and yang, I suppose. So, yeah.
If you can see the darkness, you can identify it, and then you know what the light is.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Basically. I mean, at the very base level, that's a good way of looking at it.
Yeah. And nobody hates you guys at press conferences, which is always a plus.
Yeah, no one said anything too off-color, which is fortunate. I mean, I just think, or I'd like to think of probably quite a different individual than Lars von Trier.
I should hope so.
Yeah. But, you know, I also haven't made these films and haven't been banned by Cannes, but then, you know.
Well, you're young.
Yeah, there's still time. There's still time to get banned. Banned from Cannes.
Oh. That's a good title for something.
Yeah.
It'll probably be his autobiography or his, the biopic they make of him.
Right. Oh, yeah, who would make his biopic? Other than Herzog.
He's left, yeah. Herzog would be amazing.
Yeah.
I look upon him and see only cruelty. It applies to everything.
Yeah. It's funny. It's a good impression.
Yeah, thanks. I've had years.
Yeah, I bet.
Did you... Actually, I should ask. Is the new album different from the older ones in any way? Are you guys moving in a new direction? Is there something...
Yeah, I think it's, you know...
Different.
I think it's got to be... I mean, it's got to be different because it's... You know, from the first thing when Kevin and I got together, that was in 2000. That's 17 years ago.
Yeah.
And then You Forgotten Peoples a couple years later, and we're very different people at that point. And, you know, yeah, every album just signifies a different chapter.
Mm-hmm.
So... But there's always going to be, you know... I think when you put bands together, and bands generally sound like a band, whether it's Broken Social Scene or The Who or The Shins, mm-hmm. or, you know, The Runaways, or, you know, whoever. I mean, you put individuals in a room together, something's going to get spat out, and there's going to be some common ground that gets reinterpreted over the years or gets retold, but there's still something recognizable about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's something very recognizable about Broken Social Scene's music. But this record, I mean, you know, you don't want to talk too much about an album that's not even out, and there's really only one single that's been released. But, you know, it seems like people are on board with the new song.
No, by the time they hear this, the album will
be out. Oh, yeah, yeah. But, so. Yeah, that's true. That's true. So,
is there a favorite? Is there something you want to tell people to listen for?
God, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, it's a whole body of work to try and single out one song. I just don't. We've never really been a big singles band. I mean, we've been kind of an indie singles. We've had like lots of like indie hits.
Yeah.
or maybe not lots, but we've had a handful of indie hits.
Oh, Anthem keeps recurring, I would say. Like, it's
That song has always been, you know, really good for us. And, you know, Lovers Spit or Cause Equals Time or, you know, any of these songs that have been used in films or otherwise that just continue to be liked, and we continue to play them and still enjoy playing them, so that's something.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be a terrible thing to have a batch of tunes that you're like, oh man, I've had it with this song. Yeah. I mean, yeah, you have to put certain songs on the shelf for a little bit of time, but yeah.
That fascinates me about musicians, people who, like Springsteen, who does 4-hour shows and plays everything every time, or some mixture of everything. Like, yeah. There's no period he doesn't go back to. There's no part of himself that isn't still on display.
Mm-hmm.
But he must, you know, like, Billy Joel's got to be tired of Piano Man. It's one of those things, right?
He play it every time?
I think he has to.
Does he?
Or some version of it. I guess Billy Joel's a poor example because he's locked into that specific cycle. Like, he has to play the hits.
Yeah, but he's got so many hits.
Yeah, that's true.
And he's also plays Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, like once 4 shows every year, right?
Or something. No, like once a month.
Really? I thought it was like a quarterly thing.
I think it's once. Someone told me, and I looked it up. Yeah, I think he's playing once a month. I mean, God, you go out and you have, like, you play your song and 16 or 17,000 people are on their feet screaming. I mean,
I guess you'd want to do that.
I don't know if that feeling would ever go away. Like, if you had a song that big, like, why would you not want, you know, that applause? And, like, I mean, it feels good. I can't imagine, like, writing songs that big. Like, I don't know what that feels like, but, you know, on our level, like, it feels good when people are cheering when you play a familiar song. So that level of familiarity, I mean, that's, you know, next level.
Yeah. I wonder if Von Trier gets people calling out for him to do the oldies. go back to Dogma. Go back to... Because he seems to be at war with himself stylistically, in that he evolves and then snaps back. You know, like, he sort of tried to write off the Dogma 95 movement. He says he's never actually made one, but then there's the Idiots. So he did, but...
Idiots is such a... That's like... I remember watching that just thinking, like, what the fuck is this movie?
That is the appropriate response. I saw that at a TIFF press screening where half the people in the room clearly had never seen one of his movies before.
Yeah.
They had no idea how to process it. I think I've seen all of his movies at TIFF press screenings, actually.
Yeah.
The exception of Antichrist. I missed that. I had to catch up to it later.
Remember you were saying how early you saw Melancholia, like at 8:45 in the morning.
It must have been 8:30 or 8:45.
Yeah, I think the only film I've seen really early was like 10... o'clock or 9:30 or 10 was Trainspotting. On Yonge Street.
Oh wait, were you there?
Yeah.
The 10 a.m. the press screening of Trainspotting?
Yeah.
The one at the Uptown?
Yeah.
I was there.
Yeah. That's the earliest film I'd ever... And
God, that you came out of it on a high though.
Oh, I think...
That was so great first thing in the morning.
Yeah, I think at that point we're young guys. We were smoking weed at 9:30, you know?
I was not doing that.
No.
Yeah, oh man. We were just talking about Trainspotting a couple of weeks ago because the sequel had come out.
Oh, yeah, I haven't. Not quite ready for the sequel.
It's pretty great.
Yeah?
Yeah, they found the way in. And it turns out that half the movie... How can I put this without... Well, I won't spoil it. This will come out in July. It'll be... Yeah. Half the movie is about how you can't make a sequel to Trainspotting. About how it's impossible to do that again.
And well, I think that's the only way to do it.
Yeah.
I think they must have figured that out. It's like, come on, what are we going to do? Like, retell 1996? Because a local production tried to do Ecstasy.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah.
I know I had a friend in it, and, you know, they were asking for one of my solo songs, but for no money, like $0. Right.
But
just remember, like, you're offering, like, zero, like, literally no money for the song, and how's it going to benefit my career?
Right. Exposure.
Yeah.
People die of exposure.
Yeah. I'm going to remember that one.
It's not mine. I wish I could remember who said it. God. I saw that a couple of years ago. I'm never forgetting that.
I'm going to take some ownership on that one.
Yeah, you should do that.
Yeah. Yeah, because I got asked to someone and said, hey, can I pass your number along for a DJ gig? And I just said, sure. And after this 5-minute spiel, I just said, so let me get this straight. I'm coming out there to DJ for free?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I'm in my 40s, right? Like, I got a semi-famous band. Like, you couldn't find someone else like in their 20s?
Yeah.
Anyway.
No, and free is something that you should choose to do, not that other people should expect from you.
Yeah.
That's
like my I'm DJing goal. A cystic fibrosis charity gala on Saturday.
There you go.
I'm not going to take any money, but that's my choice.
Exactly.
I'm not sure what these people's... Anyway.
Yeah.
Exposure, you can die. Like, that's funny.
My thanks to Brendan Canning, who you can hear on the new Broken Social Scene album Hug of Thunder this Friday, July 7th. And if you're hearing this before then, why not check out some of his solo stuff? I really like his 2013 album You Gots to Chill, and 2008's Something for All of Us is pretty good too. You can find Brendan on Twitter at CanningB, all one word, just the letter B, and you can find Melancholia on Blu-ray and DVD from Magnolia Home Entertainment in the United States and Entertainment One in Canada. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com. You can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at SomeoneElsesMovie.com. If you want to leave a review on iTunes, that would be very kind of you. It might even keep the earth spinning a little bit longer. Thanks for listening.
All of us, I'm afraid you're just too darn loud.